Session number 10671, Reel 3.
Colonel Baxter, Reel 3.
Well, as I was saying, why the Subedar Major was in a better position to say what was going on rather than the British officer commanding company was he'd probably spotted this problem earlier on, and he is, let us face it, one of the troops. He's grown up with them. You've got to remember that these Subedar Majors were usually chaps who were of about 35, 36 years' service, as particularly in my case, there was I with Subedar Major, 36 years' service, and I was 20 years old. And so, naturally, one listens very carefully to what he has to say. And they were absolutely invaluable. Today, after partition, of course, in India and Pakistan, I'm speaking from experience there, they didn't like Subedar Majors. They felt that they were acting as spies against Pakistan and Indian officers. But that's another story.
Is that do you think there's any truth in that?
I think I think the whole trouble is that if you can't stand up to having the Subedar Major element that we had before, you've got no faith in yourself. We knew that, after all, we were in a way, we were pale faces, we were British officers and they are Indian officers, and though we have experience and so on, you have got to be prepared to listen to what a man of considerable experience, of army experience and years of service, if he spots something that is wrong, then by all intents, listen to him. You may not believe him, you may not take any action on it, but at least this is another source of information. It is quite wrong to turn it down merely because you are suspicious that he's acting as some sort of spy. Whole trouble, you see, with it is a different concept today entirely, is that in those days, the Subedar Major and so on was dealing with, if you like, mercenaries, alien British officers. Today, if they had them, which they don't, a Subedar Major could be a Subedar Major today and a recognized Indian officer tomorrow. And it does make the situation rather different. I quite see that.
Were the Viceroy's commissioned officers content with the system of having the two separate categories of officer, or did any of them ever say or express the opinion that they were second-class officers?
No, never. They were very proud to be VCOs, and after all, they were very hand-picked. When you think that the strength of a town, as I say, was over 900, and I suppose you had, difficult to remember now, but let me say you had four viceroys commissioned officers per company, four companies for 16, allowing for quartermasters people and so on. 20, let us say, just over 20 viceroys commissioned, hand-picked out of 950 men. They were very proud of the position. And they realised they were handpicked, and very few mistakes were made over that. And very gallant, they proved themselves in war too.
So they didn't ever say we should be able to become King's commissioned officers.
No, they didn't expect to. They realised in many cases they didn't. They didn't have the education to start with. This has always been the bugbear, of course, in the Indian Army, is that education standards were low. This has been one of the problems in the Pakistan Army now, is the lack of education amongst officers.
Did you ever find that the political elements in India, in particular the Congress Party, tried to bring influence to bear on either the Indian officers or the troops?
No, the whole thing was that the average Indian sepoy, the average Indian officer or VCO has absolutely no time whatsoever for a politician, and he has no time for a student. Those are two chaps he cannot abide. And after partition and all the rest of it, and they're going to split up the Indian Army, they did various things. They wouldn't believe that the Indian Army was going to split up. Oh, that's just the politicians. We won't pay any attention to them. That was their attitude. They simply couldn't understand why we paid any attention to either politicians or students.
So Congress workers wouldn't even attempt to approach the army?
No, they wouldn't get anywhere.
Now, can you tell me about the degree of readiness of the particular battalion you were in for warfare? Because some people have criticised the Indian Army in terms of, well, they were all right for frontier warfare, but really not very suitable for a global war like the Second World War.
Yes, it was perfectly true, of course. They were. We were trained for the Mount for operations on the Northwest Frontier. Little did anyone... And the other point, of course, was internal security. After all, you've got to mention that before the war, the 55,000 British troops and about 480,000 Indian troops, and that was the total army force to keep down a population of, 400, 500 million, or whatever it was. And looking back, I think it's extraordinary how successful we were. So the army was trained, A, for frontier operations, and B, for internal security. Those were the two basic things. When it came down to anybody thinking in terms of jungle warfare, which is, of course, what happened in Malaya, everybody threw up their hands in horror. If you took an infantry training of those days, which was a manual on which all our army training was based, the only bit, and I remember it well, the only bit that you had in any form of jungle warfare, as we called it, were the last two pages of this, in which, in so many words, it said the discussion on this matter really needn't be gone because under modern conditions that is quite impossible. And that was all. Literally nothing at all. And this was the trouble, of course, when our luckless troops went into Malaya and so on against the Japanese, were faced with the fact that no one had ever thought that such a thing was possible. And I would say that for the rest, there's no doubt that within the meaning of the act, though, so you see, the Indian Army, when we were in Hong Kong, the Indian Army was flattered very much by the Royal Navy, because the Navy made a tremendous fuss of the First Eighth. It was the only time that the Navy ever came up against the Indian Army. They'd never met them in India, they'd never met them anywhere else. And they were amazed at the professionalism of the Indian Army. The result was that they made a tremendous fuss of them. They used to take us down in parties. We've been down in submarines twice. I've been in aircraft carriers three times. They were all the British troops. They never invited them. They said, no, the Indian Army is much more professional. We're much more interested in them. Now, with the result was that our chaps were not allowed to enter into any shooting competition against British battalions, nor in any, there used to be range-finding competitions. You know, we used to have the Barr and Stroud range-finders, and you can have a competition about judging distance and so on. They were not allowed to enter into any competition against the British battalions because it was known they would always win, the Indian battalion would always win, and it looked so bad for an Indian battalion beating a British battalion. So I do want to make the point that the training within those elements was very good. I mean, they were very professionally trained, but when it comes down to a type of warfare which no one considered possible, this is of course where the trouble really arose.
What about the introduction of new techniques of warfare? How did the Indian Army take to that? Because I noticed that you were the chemical warfare school at Pachmari.
Yes. Well, now that was it. Now that sort of thing they take. I think the interesting thing was that they Sikhs and Hindus basically. And PMs, the best type of PM, will, because he's so keen to learn, he will absorb anything you tell him like that pretty quickly. But it's rather interesting to think back. The one problems we had at the Chemical Warfare School, which was divided into two wings, you had a British wing and an Indian wing. The British wing looked after all British personnel, officers and NCOs and so on, and the Indian wing dealt entirely with the Indian Army personnel. The one weakness we found at the Chemical Warfare School on the Indian side was the Gurkhas, because Gurkha may be as tough as you make it, and he's very fine, but he is pretty thick upstairs, and it took a lot of getting into him, this meaning of he accepted gas as a form of juju, and he's really not very interested in juju. He's used to using weapons and so on. Well, it was the result that when we had courses with Gurkha officers, or Gurkha troops, rather, they always had to be run separately, because they simply could not keep up with the rest. And we always said this about Gurkha or Gurkha men, that they'll be much slower in uptake. It's perfectly true that once they've got it, but it's a very slow process teaching anything like a new weapon or a new concept and so on.
Can I ask you about the declaration of war in 1939, because the Congress politicians made a big issue of the fact that India was declared a combatant by the Viceroy without, as they put it, consultation with the Indian people. Was that ever thought to be an issue in the Indian Army amongst the actual Indians themselves?
No, really. The whole point was that I wasn't in India at the declaration of war. I was on sick leave and didn't return to India till February 1940. But the trouble was, the only trouble we had really was, and this always has been a slight trouble, a slight worry in the Indian Army, was that certain troops, particularly Sikhs, they understood, written into their constitution of joining the army, was that they would not be asked to serve outside India. And in fact, they were not to go overseas. There was something element of mustn't go over the sea to a different country. If you went from your country by land to another country next door, fine, but you mustn't go overseas. And this created a problem, and in fact created one serious, very serious mutiny, or could have been serious, in which the Central India Horse, which is a very fine cavalry regiment, in about 1940, just about September 1940, refused to go, or an element of them, refused to go on board ship on board the troop ship in Bombay. And we were forced to send troops around there and surround them and so on. And it was a very serious element, because if this had been allowed to spread, then you might have had problems with getting all the troops going to Malaya and so on. But it was nipped in the bud, and to be frank, I've always understood about three or four are executed as a result of this.
I
took part in the fact that I was with a company that went down there. We were up in Pune at that time, and we were told to rush down to Bombay and help surround the whole of the battalion just to make sure that this could be stopped.
Where were the mutinous troops located?
In Bombay.
But whereabouts in Bombay?
Well, they were, I can't remember exactly, but I mean, they refused to go on. They were brought down to the landing stage, if you see what I mean, to go on these troop ships, and they were going to the Middle East. They were going to the war in Eritrea. And at the last moment, an element of them refused to go on board. And this element was obviously spreading. So it decided to stop the whole lot going on, and all the complete regiment had to be surrounded, and the thing was nipped in the bud. I never heard of any other trouble.
Did you see any of the mutinous troops?
No, not really, no. No, we were held back in reserve. They'd got troops already, but they didn't know how serious, whether it was going to be a shooting match or what it was, but it wasn't.
So were the mutinous troops totally passive?
Yes, they were, because it was only a very small element, but the danger was, of course, of it spreading.
Do you know whether the mutinous people were officers or men?
They were VCOs and senior NCOs.
So as far as, I know you said you were on sick leave when war was declared, but as far as your recollections of your own battalion were concerned, do you recollect the question of Indian participation in the war being an issue at all?
No, not at all. No, they're very keen. Very keen town, of course, a very old regular battalion, and they were quite prepared. The attitude of Indian troops in those days for good battalion was, we've done all this training, now let's see if it works. That really was their whole attitude. And if the British officer says, well, or can point out this is a good thing to fight for, then we'll fight. That's good enough. He tells us it is. That's a good enough for us.
On this question of the relationship between the British officer and the men,
yes.
Some people have depicted it in terms of a paternalism. Is that correct?
I think it is. I think that's perfectly true. It is a most extraordinary, a very strong family feeling. And there were all sorts of occasions in which men lost their lives, and they needed protecting their British officers or doing the best they can from the British officers, and vice versa. They're treated very, very much as a family. That is why you want, of course, or that it was felt in those days, the powers that be felt, that you want to keep the name in the regiment. That's really why I had no problem when I joined the town and so on, because the name was in the regiment. It had gone from father to son, which is what they liked. They did not like people coming in from outside who thought they won't understand our funny ways and our means, and we won't, and so on. It won't work.
But was there any sense for the British officer with an Indian battalion in which he would be in loco parentis in relation to the sepoys, in which he would not be in loco parentis in relation to his British troops if he were in a British battalion?
No, I can't say no, no, no. I think the interesting thing is that the feeling between, I don't know whether this is sort of leads on to it, but the feeling between a British battalion and Indian battalion, I find extraordinary, is that the British troop realized he had a great admiration, really, for Indian battalion because of the sheer professionalism. And an Indian sepoy is not interested particularly in women. He's not interested in wine, women, and song. His whole of his spare time is spent in learning his job, working on how to clean a weapon out, dismantle a weapon, and so on. Whereas the British troops' attitude, of course, well, we work for so many hours, and then we're going to enjoy ourselves, which is normal. Isn't it? And so there was a sneaking admiration for the British Army of the Indian sepoy. But they couldn't understand how on earth they could go on forever doing this and not having any fun and games. And that was reflected, I think, in terms, and it was reflected when we were called out on internal security matters, and we had to be alongside British troops.
Can you tell me about the internal security situation in India now? Because, of course, in 1942, when the Japanese were knocking on the door of India, the Congress launched the Quit India movement.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what your personal memories are of that?
Well, my personal memories were that the army didn't realize it was as serious, I think, as perhaps the civilian government knew it was, and all our efforts were really spent on keeping communications open. It was so vital to keep the railways going, telecommunications going, and so on, between India and Burma. And it was very easy when that vast stretch of territory and so on, bearing in mind that about 60% of Indian railways is worked on single track, and this is one of the problems, and the weight of movements it had of troops and supplies and all the rest of it, and it was so vital to keep those lines open. All our efforts were on that, really. To stop lines being blown up, because you really could have lost the war against the Japanese on that front if they had been successful in cutting the lines for any length of time. And that's where our main efforts were, as I remember it.
What, if anything, did you see of damage to communications?
Oh, I've seen bridges blown up and that sort of thing, and one had to admire the speed at which Indian sappers can throw a bridge and get going again. Bearing in mind how important it was. They were very good at that. And you have all these famous Irish bridges and things that they you know what an Irish bridge means, of course. Well, an Irish bridge always strikes me as a very good name for it. An Irish bridge is basically not a bridge at all. It means that you have it, taking it that there are two levels of that particular river. One during the monsoon or heavy rains, which may be anything you like. Let's say up to 15 or 20 feet in depth of water. Whereas in the dry season, it may be only down to 6 inches or a foot. So an Irish bridge was thrown across, and it was a proper bridge, I mean cement and all the rest of it, so as to be a bridge at the lowest possible level of that river. And that was always known as an Irish bridge.
So, can you tell me whether you caught anybody who was attempting to disrupt communications?
I can't remember particularly. I expect we did sometime, but I really can't remember. And if we did, well, then we just hand them over. We didn't. We just hand them over to the civilian authorities, to the police.
Where were you doing this guarding communications?
Well, we were doing it down at in Patna, down in Bihar, we were then.
In Patna City?
Well, outside. Ranchi and Patna. Ranchi is down in that part in Bihar.
Was there much damage in that area?
Well, not in the area we were. I wouldn't say so, no. Nothing that we couldn't be kept control of. But it did mean, of course, that we had to waste all our troops. You didn't dare send a train with valuable rolling stock, and let alone the passengers in it, straight away down a line. You had to always send an engine out in front, all by itself, about, 300 or 400 yards ahead, so that if it was going to be blown up, it was only the engine, naturally, not the whole train, which is very serious from every point of view.
Were the troops themselves ever attacked during the Indian movement?
No, I wouldn't say that. Because I think the ordinary civilian is very frightened of an Indian troop, you know. Very frightened indeed.
What did the attitude of your battalion, the Indians in your battalion, seem to be towards the agitators of the Quit India movement?
Well, they thought they were the lowest of the low. So absolutely, I mean, they thought they were the absolute scum. Of course, you see, the whole attitude of an Indian sepoy, he's very proud of being a sepoy. He's hand-picked. You could recruit, we could have doubled the size of the Indian Army in the war, and I don't realize that the Indian Army at 1945 was 2.25 million strong, with 39,000 British officers. Now, that 2.25 million, you could have doubled that if you'd only had any arms or ammunition to give them. There were none of them. It was the largest volunteer army the world will ever have seen. All right, the British officers had to go, but not the sepoys. And therefore the sepoys felt themselves to be very hand-picked and looked down on these people enormously. They were lesser mortals as far as they were concerned.
Was there any sense amongst the Indian officers or Indian troops that the Congress people who were conducting the agitation were stabbing India in the back?
Well, we never discussed that much. You see, in the army, we tried to keep clear of politics. That's one thing you learned. You did not discuss, unless they were pushed under your nose, you really tried to keep clear of politics.
So they never volunteered an opinion about it?
Not really, that I can recall. You wouldn't have raised it. If he had raised, if any senior VCO or anyone like that had raised it, you might have discussed the matter, but you wouldn't have made a thing of it, and you most unlikely that you would have started it yourself.
What was the image of the Japanese soldier amongst the Indian Army?
Well, what do you mean, what do they think of him? They thought he was extremely well-trained and absolutely, utterly ruthless. And I think they were amazed at their efficiency and the standard of their training, because the Indian Army always rather flattered itself that it was pretty well trained. They came up against these people, and I think there's another element which surprised all of us, was that, of course, The Indian sepoy is prepared to do his stuff and if necessary, die for his country. But these chaps were absolutely fanatical, and dying meant nothing to them at all. That's what astounded them. There was the fact that they were better equipped with light machine guns and things like that. Their equipment was better. We were depending far too much on our old friend, the 303 rifle.
Some people have said that there was a danger of the Indian army being too much in awe of the Japanese soldier as somebody who couldn't be defeated at a certain stage of the war.
I, as I say, I virtually wasn't there. But the point was, in talking to my brother's officers, and they came out, I wouldn't say that was true. They were so angry at in a way of being beaten as they were beaten. Let's face it, when the Japs first landed, that they were determined, you know, in a way, to get their own back. They were not going to give in to these chaps. And they were determined to do the best they possibly could with such equipment and so on that they had. And they did.
Did you, at what stage in your service in the Indian Army, did you feel that India was going to become an independent country?
It's an interesting point. My father used to say he was wondering whether, and I'm quoting about, you see, 1930-31, whether it was right to allow me to go ahead and become a King's Indian Cadet, in other words, join the Indian Army. Because, and he was very astute in these things, He discussed with all sorts of people, and I'm quoting 1930-31, and he came to the conclusion, I remember him telling me afterwards, that he thought the Indian Army, as we knew it then, would just about see me out, but only just, and there was an element of risk whether in fact I would be able to complete my service in the Indian Army as it was. And of course it transpires on how right he was. It came a good deal quicker, eventually, than he expected, but it showed that his calculations were not far out.
Can you tell me what you remember about the transfer of power in 46-47? What are your own personal reminiscences?
My own personal reminiscences, it was the most tricky time I've ever heard in the whole of my life. I was a very young CO. In fact, I was the youngest CO. I think I was 35 then, about that. And I've heard that I was the youngest, not the sort of temporary one war, but virtually a regular CO, you know, and that sort of thing. At 35, very young for the Indian Army. And I found myself confronted with a semi-political situation, the like of which I had no background, no training. We none of us had. We had training in the war, we'd trained all the rest.